This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. While most college students were enjoying their summer vacation, Rai Barkat was hanging out in one of the largest slums in Africa. In the summer of 2000, while a student at UNC Chapel Hill, Rai went to Kibera in Nairobi, Kenya, slums about the size of Central Park in New York, but more than a million people live there, and they live in desperate conditions. Rai decided he had to do something, but first he had to fulfill a commitment to the Marines. He was in college on an ROTC scholarship. After graduation, he served in the Marines for 5 years while also working on a nonprofit to help the people of Kibera. The organization is called Carolina for Kibera, and Rai has written a memoir about the experience. It's called It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace. And he joins us in the studio now to talk more about it. Welcome back to the program, Rai Barkat. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here.
Tell us about, we should lay out for us one more time, because we've spoken about this before, but it's been a while. Carolina for Kibera, what is it?
Yeah, CFK is a non-governmental organization. I co-founded it with two Kenyans, a widowed nurse and a street child who grew up in Nairobi, Kenya, 10 years ago, in order to invest in young leaders. And we started off by using sports, in this case soccer, to bring different ethnic groups together. I initially went there because I knew I was going into the Marines. That was really my first calling, in part because of my father, who had served, and many of my earliest mentors who were his friends. And it was before September 11th, so I assumed that the types of missions we'd face would be of a peacekeeping type of nature or interventions during ethnic strife. And so I, after taking some anthropology courses and some Swahili classes at UNC Chapel Hill, I arrived in Kibera, rented a small shack, a 10 by 10, and spent time meeting young people who were my age, who were incredibly talented, but just had very few opportunities. And what this book is, we're actually just coming off of a 26-city tour, largely to colleges and high schools, because I wrote it principally for students. And what I hope that it does is that it presents two forms of service, military service and what some call social entrepreneurship, and takes readers into the experiences that of both of these, as I had them at times simultaneously, as they sort of clashed and converged in my head and heart.
Tell us what you thought you could do, because anybody who's been in a situation like that, I don't think there's anything like being in the slums in and around Nairobi, but it is overwhelming. There is a crushing sense of despair. I would describe it that way. Why do you think you can come out of that and do something about it?
Well, you know, Frank, that was the observation that I had in that first week. But then I started listening, and I started having conversations with young men and women who were my age and who had this remarkable talent and ambition, but so few opportunities to develop them. And what I sort of walked away with was that small resources directly into the hands of remarkable young people can make a transformative impact. And I wanted to play a role in that. I realized that I couldn't do it alone. That's the fundamental premise of Carolina for Kibera, and that is that the change can't happen from outside of the community. It has to be driven from within. But it can. And sometimes it can with small amounts, as little as $26, which has a lot of symbolism in the book, because one of my co-founders took a grant for just $26 in the summer of 2000. Widowed nurse living in a 10 by 10. And she took that grant, sold vegetables for 6 months, and then decided to pursue her dream, which was to start a small medical clinic. That clinic became a part of our youth leadership development program in Carolina for Kibera, and today treats over 40,000 patients a year in the heart of the community with two Kenyan medical doctors. And it all started with $26 in the hands of a remarkable person. And so it might not be Kibera for young people who are looking to make an impact. But I think Kibera, Tabitha, they're powerful metaphors and ways that people can apply to their own lives and the differences that they want to make. And that's my great hope with this book, is really that it's a source of both inspiration as well as information for the young doers out there.
Tell us about your other partner, how you met him and your relationship with him.
Yeah, Salim Mohammed is a scrappy fellow, looks very different from me. And of course, we have different faiths and very different upbringings. And he was a leader in a neighboring sports program that was using soccer to bring young kids together. And he challenged me on my first summer. He said, you know, you're coming in here and you're going to get research. But what's the community going to see in return? I didn't have an answer for him, and it weighed on me, and something else from the Marines weighed on me, and it was a line that expressed a certain value from the institution, and that is have a bias for action, a bias for action. And so I was thinking about these two lines, and one day sent Salim an email in my senior year and proposed that we start an organization, model it after the one that he was leading, and have it use soccer as a way to help young leaders grow directly in this particularly large slum community. And what was so surprising about this experience was that my military commanders, at the very few times when the two worlds sort of converged, my military commanders were always supportive of our work in Kibera. And I think that they were supportive, and part of the reason why we've seen a lot of outreach from veteran communities now is that they were supportive because they recognized that small things to prevent violence are always far more effective, cost-effective, than the price of intervening during it.
Do you think there's something about that, about having seen military action, having seen things blow up and watch people die, that makes you even more sensitive to that, sensitive to, or perhaps look deeper for answers that will prevent violence?
I think in many cases it is, and it certainly was the case for my father, who was deeply conflicted about his experience in Vietnam, and I think has this division that many veterans feel, and that is that he derives so much meaning and identity from the Marines, and yet it also wounded him in severe ways, in ways that he still to this day is not fully comfortable speaking about in public, in part because he had many of his brothers and sisters, as did I, who gave so much more than he did. And that is the dichotomy. And what I've tried to do with this book is show both the strengths as well as the severe limitations of the use of military force, and frankly, some of the effects of violence on the human spirit. And I was listening to your show earlier today when the guest was talking about Afghanistan and the effects of violence on the children in Afghanistan in particular. And, you know, as I was going through this experience in Fallujah as a Marine, I was too numb to the conditions to really understand what was transpiring in my own head. I mean, it took the process of reflecting over years writing this book to really sort it out. But one of the things that was happening was that I wasn't seeing kids as kids. I was seeing them as part of a larger enemy apparatus. And sometimes they were wrapped up in violence at very young ages.
You had an experience at Abu Ghraib, didn't you?
Yeah, this was almost a dramatic experience for me, because we had an assassination. And it was the chairman of the Fallujah City Council. And I interviewed the assassin. And the assassin was only 11 years old. 11 years old. And his life is almost already behind him. And surely at a certain level, you've got to wonder, there just has to be a better way than this. And I think there is. I think that there are, frankly, lessons that can be applied from our 10 years of work in the Kibera slum in Nairobi. I think we can practice more participatory development. We can take the long view. We can listen more effectively before doing. And this is about, at the heart and soul of it, it's about investing in young people's potential in a long-term type of way.
I think the thing that people might not even understand, you think about the poverty when you describe places like Kibera and other slums, you know, immediately the poverty, hunger, health problems, those things come to mind. But there's a kind of post-traumatic stress. Everybody has endured and experienced some kind of violence. There is a kind of paramilitary that runs things, and it is a violent situation day and night. You grow up in that situation, you are wounded at every level.
Yeah.
And this is a million people, and that's the largest slum in Nairobi, but not the only one, because there's Mutare, which is 500,000 on the other side of town, and a couple of others all around it.
It's easy to get overwhelmed and think there's nothing that an individual can do. But I think that you have to step back, and it goes back to a Margaret Mead quote, which I'm fond of because my mom gave me the middle name Mead after Margaret Mead. And the quote is, you know, never doubt the power of a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens to change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. When we were speaking at the Gates Foundation a few weeks ago, it's now emblazoned on the wall of the foundation. Many college students know it. It's not an individual. It's not a citizen. It is small groups of thoughtful, committed citizens who form bonds that are fundamentally rooted in trust and are long-term. And that's what we have. That is the foundation that made our non-governmental organization possible, that enabled it to grow from a couple hundred members to now more than 50,000.
So that's the good news, that 40,000 people are treated at the clinic, that there are young women who go through a program that is designed to help them become leaders and gain sovereignty over their own bodies. That's another program. It's part of Caroline for Kibera. But the slum is still there,
yeah.
And it's going to be there tomorrow, and it's going to be there for the next couple of decades, don't you think?
The infrastructure is appalling. And the population pressures are continuing to mount. By some estimates, up to a sixth of our world's population will live in conditions like Kibera by 2020. I think we were asked a question when we were giving a presentation at another college. And the question was, are you motivated by a sense of guilt? It's an interesting question because when you go into Kibera, you can feel that. Perhaps you felt it when you came and visited our Binti Pamoja program 2 years ago. I sometimes still feel it, but guilt is not sustainable. It's not. And the real driver with this work, for those of us who have committed large parts of our lives to it, is this daily sense of inspiration that we get from the partners who we work with, who we learn from, as well as who learn from us. That's where the change will be possible. That's where the systemic change will be possible. It's not going to happen overnight. Issues involving poverty and violence, there are no simple solutions. There are no quick and easy solutions. But there are dramatic changes that can happen when local leaders are empowered.
So you go there, you see the problem, you're challenged by a friend who lives there and says, "What are you leaving, and what are you leaving behind?" And you have a vision. There are disappointments along the way, right? Times when people say quite cynically, look, it's not about building community, it's about stipends. Where are the stipends? Tell us about some of the frustrations along the way and some moments that you had to say, wait a minute, this my dream was naive and this is silly.
And I've tried to lay this bare in the book, and it's not simply about successes. It's about the betrayals, the setbacks, the death threats at times. You know, I think that when I look back at the experience, making change in the world, whether you're in a military uniform or as a nonprofit or in the corporate sector, if you're trying to make change, you're going to confront failure. And it's not the failures that count, but the way that you react to them. In some ways, I derive some inspiration from another Marine Corps motto. We're sort of fond of our mottos in the Marines. But this one's a good one. It's improvise, adapt, and overcome. Improvise, adapt, and overcome. Have a broad sense of the mission and where you're going, and then be ready for the punches to come. Be ready for the setbacks, because they will. And
well, failure's one thing. You know, when you talk about, they said they were going to put the plumbing in, the plumbing hasn't come yet, they were going to put in the lights, and 6 months later, they're still not in. That's kind of a failure. Maybe you have to move. But the disappointment, the sense of betrayal, expectations going in when a friend who you thought was very close decides, you know, not to pay back a loan, and you feel deeply, deeply hurt by this, how you have to adjust and review your own expectations going in and maybe actually tell yourself my expectations weren't quite right to begin
with. Yeah, the transformation that happened for me was that I came in as a 20-year-old American in the military, can-do spirit, and thought initially that that I could really drive the change, when in fact it has to be driven from within the community. And that's what Salim and Tabitha, my two co-founders, who are really the hero and heroine of the book, taught me. And they've got to, you know, it has to be locally owned. And this, I think, applies really broadly as we think about, you know, our own foreign policy issues, but also work back home, you know, communities that are affected right here in Durham by cycles of violence and poverty. How can that change be sparked from within? And often I think it can if we confront our stereotypes, if we confront our own fears and form relationships with people who may be very different from us superficially, but who share common values.
So the commitment then is just to engage the problem and not necessarily to go in with all the answers.
I think that's really where it has to start. And that begins with listening. And listening is not always a particular attribute.
They don't teach you that in the Marines, do they? Well, they listen to orders, I guess.
It's true. It's an area where I think that we can work on.
So you're doing it. What do you hope to accomplish with the book?
So I wrote this primarily for college students. We've just come off our 26-city tour. My main hope is that this is a book that will help inspire and inform others, and that it will convey a simple message, and that is that you don't have to wait to make an impact. You don't have to wait for wealth or status or power or prestige. Talent's universal, opportunity's not. You can engage it, and you can do it now.
How did your ideas about this change once you got in the military? Was there anything about military service that changed your view about this particular philanthropic enterprise of yours?
The Marines, I think the Marines helped enable me in Kibera and vice versa. And that forms a crux of this narrative. I mean, that is the tension that I'm narrating back and forth with the book. The Marines gave me some of the things that might come pop immediately to mind when you think about military. Situational awareness, to be aware of your security and your environment and how to navigate a foreign place. Discipline, the ability to set a mission and unify a team behind it. And first and foremost, and most important of all, the word that we see so many leaders failing to understand and appreciate in our culture these days, and that is integrity, because it all starts with integrity. It starts with the integrity that enables the trust to form and for the relationships to really carry their own weight forward. And that's true whether you're a Marine in Fallujah, Iraq, or a nonprofit worker on the ground in the slums of Nairobi.
Rye, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Rye Barcott, co-founder of Carolina for Kibera, author of the memoir It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace. For more information about Rye and the book, you can go to ithappenedonthewaytowar.com. What's the Carolina for Kibera website?
CarolinaForKibera.org.
There you go, K-I-B-E-R-A. And thank you for listening to The State of Things. Comment on the show if you want. Go to our website, stateofthings.org. Check us out on Facebook as well. The State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. We get help from Jeremy Loeb and Julia Cox. Anna Cassell is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.